Hello and welcome. I'm Stephen Brook, back with another edition of Media Talk. Coming up, didn't they do well? Champagne, Pims and private jets. The BBC publishes the expenses of its top executives. Can Mark Thompson survive the headlines and the latest crisis for the corporation? Plus, the new Empress of Wapping, Rebecca Wade, takes the leap from Sun editor to News International chief executive. But can she do the job, and who will replace her? Also in the podcast.
After 572 days, 13,728 hours, and what must be millions of minutes, it's time for us to say farewell.
As Satanta switches off, we discuss the perils of sports broadcasting. And this.
The answer, of course, is content. If we don't drive that market by attracting people to digital programming, then we are finished.
It's crunch time for the wireless industry. We look ahead to the 2009 Radio Festival. All this and much, much more. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, it's all gone a bit quiet in Medialand offices. It seems like most of The Guardian has decamped to Glastonbury, while a good chunk of the BBC has relocated to SW19 for 2 weeks of Wimbledon. So, whilst I tuck into some overpriced strawberries and try to look stylish in wellies and tennis shorts, let me introduce you to our guests. Emily Bell is The Guardian's Director of Digital Content. Now, Emily, I've known you for about 5 years. I still can't work out whether you'd rather be wigging out in front of the pyramid stage or grunting away on centre court.
I always like a grunt on centre court. Do you know, I would like to do both, but since the BBC has dramatically cut back on its corporate hospitality, I won't be going to Wimbledon this year because that's the only way I ever used to get in. And I will be going to Glastonbury because, fortunately, The Guardian has not cut back on its corporate hospitality, which actually arrives in the form of a ticket.
Lucky
every
for
year.
You.
A free pass to Trenchfoot. And a nasty waterborne disease.
But you're not tenting, are you?
No, I am paying. I'm paying for myself to stay in a very bijou residence office. Nobody, can I just say, in their right mind would actually stay on site. Certainly not nobody in my advanced years. You know, not unless you want to drown in the night.
Indeed. Paul Robinson, the broadcasting consultant and managing director of KidsCo TV. Now, we know your answer to this one, because your family's actually been sponsoring Wimbledon, hasn't it, since the 1930s?
Oh, drinks yes, company. Absolutely, and such good value too.
All right, enough of this frippery. It's time to get serious.
The World at One. This is Sean Lay with 30 minutes of news and comment. Today's headlines. Conservative MPs are to pay back another £125,000 in expenses after an internal inquiry. Meanwhile, the expenses claimed by the BBC's top executives have just been published, including £500 to replace a stolen handbag. The BBC's Director General tells us that the saga of MPs' expenses had led the corporation to take a fresh view of how much to disclose.
I've sent a message to my colleagues saying we really should make sure that we only are excluding information when there's an overwhelmingly strong reason to do with commercial confidentiality.
Well, that's how Radio 4 reported this week's big media story, which is still developing at the time of our podding. The BBC's released the expenses of the corporation's most senior executives, and they make for pretty tasty reading. There's all sorts in there. Jana Bennett's haircut and blow dry before she went on TV. We've had Mark Thompson spending £2,500 to fly his family back to the UK when the Ross Brand affair kicked off from his holidays. He also spent £100 on a bottle of champagne for Brucey to celebrate his 80th birthday. Emily, none of this looks good, and it's a bit of a difficult time for the BBC. What do you make of this?
Well, if these were the expenses of senior media executives in commercial companies, I think you would think they looked actually quite modest and rather reasonable. But if you set them in the context of public service organisations and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, some of them do look rather out of whack. I'd actually just like to correct you, Stephen. You said £500 for a stolen handbag. I think that was actually the cost of half a stolen handbag. Though arguably, you know, we shouldn't be picking up the bill for that at all. So I think that it's going to be another of those issues in terms of how the BBC is perceived by the wider world. So in other words, all of those people who are very upset about Jonathan Ross's salary, about the behaviour of the metropolitan media elite, will go through these and say they take taxis everywhere, they're always having lunch with each other, it usually involves alcohol, you know, is this really what we're paying for? And as I say, actually, you know, I'm sure that kind of against the expenses of, you know, a number of other people of this level in other organisations, maybe even here at The Guardian, these don't look completely, you know, there's clearly not a sort of a really outrageous gravy train, but in terms of public service expenses, they do look a little embarrassing.
Nevertheless, Paul Robinson, some of them look bad and some executives are going to be either embarrassed or damaged by some of these claims, aren't they?
Well, I think the internal hospitality figures are large. You know, I mean, £1,512 in an internal staff meeting for Ashley Highfield, £800 in an internal staff meeting for John Smith, another £1,287 for another John Smith meeting. These are quite a lot. These are quite large numbers, you know, for internal meetings, as Emily says, entertaining each other. In the overall scheme of things, they're not huge. But I guess the other question is, to what extent are these totally complete? And we don't really know, when a group of executives get together, which one actually picks up the tab. And certainly, you know, in other organisations, it's quite usual for someone to pick it up and someone else may be involved. And you never quite know who the group is. So there may be more here than we actually see.
We're not
so
getting the full picture. These might be a bit redacted,
possibly.
Are they?
Well, not
we
redacted,
really,
but you don't quite know who's actually on the receiving end of the hospitality when it's internal.
Okay, but I mean, the BBC operates within a showbiz industry, doesn't it? So it's part of the job of these executives to keep the talent on side and...
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the argument. And when people see that, you know, Mark Thompson's bought Bruce Forsyth a bottle of Krug for his 80th birthday, on the one hand, there's talent management. On the other hand, you might think, you know, if you're paid £800,000 a year as Mark Thompson is, and you want to give Bruce Forsyth it, did he send Bruce Forsyth a birthday present and say, happy birthday, this is from the BBC, or did he say, this is from me? I mean, this is kind of nuanced and sort of small things. I think, actually, interestingly, the Director General seems to have been pretty frugal by and large. He's not too bad. I mean, the thing about the private jet is going to be the thing that gets the headlines.
Yes.
But actually, on the other hand, if you were working for a company who said, we want you back here tomorrow, you're in the middle of your family holiday, and your spouse kicks off and says, if you think I'm staying here with the kids, you must be, you know, mad, don't bother coming home at the end of it, probably most organisations would fly their most senior person back and their family back as well.
Possibly. They might not spend that amount of money. I mean, they might do, you know, scheduled airline flights, and they might not necessarily go business class or first class. So I think it's slightly luxurious, but it's not extremely, you know, it's not excessive. I think the question might also be asked, what's the Deputy Director General doing? Because surely, you know, when the DG is away, the Deputy DG should fill in and they should liaise on the phone. Does he have to fly everywhere for every crisis?
Well, certainly with Ross Brown, it was because of the failure of the rest of the executive to sort out the mess that Thompson had to come back, Emily, wasn't it?
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. And I think that's a good point, that you have all these senior executives, so they ought to be able to cover for each other.
Well,
one of them's on holiday. My personal favourite was actually a spot of somebody else on the web, on our website here, which was that I think that Ashley Highfield, who at the time was head of Future Media and Technology, bought a new Apple iPod for testing a day before they were released.
Right.
Which is, and you also kind of think, you know, would you not just ask Apple if you could have one for testing?
Yeah.
And then if you liked it, you might think about spending your own money on one. It's, I say this bitterly because I've never been given a single piece of free flashy Apple kit, even though I keep saying I'm Director of Digital Content. Would it be possible for me to have an iPhone? And quite rightly, the IT department here saying no.
We've had MPs who've gone through the similar expenses revelations. A lot of them have effectively been fired. They're not going to stand for re-election. Sitting here very early stages of this unfolding story, it doesn't really seem that BBC heads are going to roll, Paul Robinson.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I think in overview, this is actually not bad. I mean, you know, I think there's a little bit of excess, you know, on internal entertaining, but overall it's nothing like the issue with MPs. There doesn't appear to be any wholesale abuse, maybe a little bit generous here and there, but overall it's not a scandal, no.
Do you agree with that, Emily?
Yeah, I do agree with that, actually. And I think that there's another point here which shouldn't be lost in this, which is that actually the senior executives at the BBC are much, much, much better paid than MPs. And, you know, you might go back to the point where you say, if you're setting your salary levels at the right pitch, you can actually kind of be a little bit more hardline on expenses. And I think that's one of the big difference in this. As I say, they look very modest compared to some of the MPs' claims. But on the other hand, these are people with salaries of £500,000 a year upwards.
One more quick final thought, Emily. This is all happening when there's a big ding-dong over the licence fee and top slicing and bad relations between the BBC and the government. Will this have an impact?
It's sort of a death by a thousand cuts for the BBC. Every time there is a story like this, that it has a little bit more of an impact. And I think that it won't help them. When we see the Daily Mail and the Times and the Sun get hold of these tomorrow,
And Media Guardian
I just don't think that sort of most people take the view that Paul and I take, which is, yes, we can see that actually, you know, in a certain context, these look sort of slightly outrageous. But actually, yeah, you know, in the wider picture, they're probably quite, you know, in the cost of doing business in this environment, they're not necessarily completely sort of out of kilter, sure, or abusive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But to someone actually, you know, doing maybe a more modest job, you know, seeing this amount of money being spent on expenses, that's their month's salary, they'll go, wow, this looks crazy. And you can understand why they react like that. Yes. That's why it's a problem.
Okay, moving on, but not entirely away from the BBC. There's a big survey and report released by the BBC this week into swearing, taste and decency. And the headlines from it seem to be the BBC is going to crack down on swearing before 10 p.m. at night, and that it doesn't want any of its comedy programmes to humiliate guests and play too much for vicious laughs. So it seems the shadow of Ross and Brand still looms large. This is how Nikki Campbell handled the issue of swearing on the Five Live phone-in.
Another thing, people find use of, when people say Jesus and take the Lord's name in vain, a lot of people of faith find that offensive. But I remember being holed up into the controller's office at Radio 1 when I was on Radio 1. Richard, are you listening? Are you there too?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When I was, this was many years ago, but it shows how times change. And I'd said an F word, but I'd said F-A-R-T on the radio. And I was hauled into the controller's office to be hauled over the coals for saying that on the radio. Now, it's just an indication there, Richard, isn't it, how times have changed? The word you use, or one uses, or I certainly use when I stub my toe, for example, I would never...
Oh, yes, you wouldn't say curses.
I wouldn't say, oh, flip, oh, bother. I wouldn't, but it's not the word I would ever use on the radio intentionally.
Well, Nikki, perhaps you'll want to put your earmuffs on for this.
Georgie Wordsley is master of the old Surrey and Burstow and West Kent. Kent Hunt is out hunting this morning in Lingfield in Surrey. Good morning.
Good morning to you. That's a bit of a slip of the tongue.
I know, I do apologise for that. It's very early in the morning and these things do happen, and I feel exceptionally embarrassed about it, and I'm going to have to try and proceed with the interview now. So apologies for that. Lots of you are mentioning that they'll still be talking about the cunt that the West Kent hunt that shall not be mentioned in 500 years' time. I don't believe it.
Well, this sort of thing could happen to anyone, couldn't it, Paul? And you've worked for Radio 1 before, but he did the right thing because he apologised.
I thought he handled it really well. He apologised, he admitted he had to go on with the interview. I think people would forgive him for that. And, you know, anyone could fall into that situation. You know, it's a live show. I think actually it's a great example of how to handle it. Because the point about swearing is it's in the context, isn't it? You know, swearing can work in context. It's not, offence is not just about using bad language. It's the context in which the language is used.
And whether you're using it to abuse someone. That clip was from a couple of years ago. It seems though, Emily, that they're going to be taking a lot tougher line on the deliberate use of swearing in BBC programmes, and that BBC executives are going to be, you know, pre-approving bad language. Is that the right way to go, do you think, Emily?
Maybe. I've heard it before. I'm fairly sure that sort of 3 or 4 years ago we had a similar diktat, which was 9 o'clock is a watershed, not a waterfall.
Yep.
In other words, keep your FCs and MFs to yourself until 9:30, maybe. But it is this zeitgeist thing about bullying and aggression,
yes,
and the contextualising of bad language in that, being very anti-zeitgeist. I've had two or three key executives at the BBC recently in just sort of private chats going, I'm not sure about, you know, I think the zeitgeist is moving away from that. So they're all very much on message. So you can expect, I was going to say sort of few... the schedule, but apparently Jane Bennett approves those on a regular basis.
Every C word that is uttered over the airwaves, she's got to have ticked off on, apparently.
No wonder she loses her handbag regularly.
Yes, apparently.
All right,
well, look. wave through, then go to Jane Bennett. Sorry, no, we can't say that. We're going to have to take that out.
Well,
I won't approve it. When it comes to me for approval, I'm going to turn it down.
You are the director of digital content. You can decline to approve your own potty mouth.
you did manage to get the word content out correctly.
Okay, well, look, we're going to leave the BBC there and sweary words. You can have your say on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, but please keep it clean. Well, she's done it. The ambitious red-headed, red-top editor, Rebecca Wade, has been angling for an executive job, and this week she finally got it. Just 10 days after her wedding, Uncle Roop's wedding present to his favourite editor was to put the Sun boss in charge of all aspects of News International Papers as the company's chief executive. She'll start in September and report to James Murdoch, who's staying on as executive chairman, but he has his hands full running News Corp's European and Asian TV interests. A woman in charge of a media company, that'll never work, huh, Emily?
No, I've often said it's a very bad idea. we struggle by at The Guardian with being mostly run by women, even if the men don't know it.
Well, actually, if you look upon the whole UK newspaper market, there's Sly Bailey.
We do much better. You've got
this has changed the balance, though, hasn't it?
You've got Marjorie Scardino. You've got Sly Bailey. You've got Carolyn McCall at GMG. You've you're already way ahead of the industry averages in other companies,
yeah.
In terms of sort of people having the top job. And I think that Rebecca's been after this for a long time.
Yes.
I think she's held on to the Sun editor's job for 6 years without falling out of favour with the family.
Yeah,
which
few of her predecessors managed.
Very few of her predecessors managed, and I think she's probably done that by being very smart, by being a good editor, by being not too proprietorial about the Sun. You know,
yes.
it was never completely identified with her in the same way that it was with Kelvin McKenzie.
Yes,
and also I think there is something about Les Hinton, who I suppose was the last sort of chief executive who was not, you know, James Murdoch or that combined chairman chief exec role. It was a slightly different job for him because, of course, his executive chairman was Rupert Murdoch, who was largely not in London. Actually,
yes.
James is based in London.
Yes.
And he'll stay at Wapping. And, of course,
yeah.
they did, I think, make an appointment for chief operating officer as well,
yes.
in the last 6 months, which is a guy called, I think, Jan Kirpel, who
yes.
came from Boston Consulting.
Yes.
So there is a slightly more kind of dilute management team. However, you know, it is a significant move for her. We haven't got an immediate successor at The Sun.
No.
Partly, I suspect, because it is very much her appointment, or that's how it's being played. So,
yes.
you know, if it wasn't her appointment, they would have probably given it to Dominic Mohan immediately. But,
yeah.
you know, she's so it's sort of, you know, it's making her look like she's very much in charge of the papers side
yes.
of the business.
And
of course,
which newspaper editor gets to choose their successor? Very
well,
few.
Exactly. And I think that's sort of, you know, that shouldn't be undercooked. That's quite a big thing.
So it's clear, Paul, that...
It will also really, really probably upset John Withrow, who is the...
Well, we've got a comment on the blog from Oliver1704. And he's saying, I'd love to know why John Withrow didn't get the job. He's been coveting that position since Les Hinton moved. Wonder how he feels.
Well, always a problem when someone rises through the ranks and they have a lot of peers or seniors who then they have to start to manage. And that's one of the challenges. And they must have thought that through. John Withrow is clearly someone who's valued and they want to retain in the organisation. So either John has got something we don't know about, or Rebecca clearly is going to be, you know, given the task of managing. She's gone from researcher to, you know, chief executive in 20 years. What a great advert for young journalists coming in. You can do it that quickly.
What do you think have been her triumphs and failures at The Sun in terms of memorable front pages, etc.?
Well, I suppose that what she was described as a campaigning journalist,
yeah.
Probably one of her most controversial spells was the Sarah's Law spell,
yeah.
which was arguably
was just huge. I wasn't here at the time, but
it was an enormous, galvanised nation, and
appalled,
but it also
equally.
Upset
yeah.
anybody who knew anything at all about child protection. It was a kind of classic
yeah.
case of where not to be.
They had another one actually much more recently at The Sun with Baby P, which was similarly huge.
Again,
they had 1.5 million signatures to Downing Street.
Yes, I was going to say again that the Baby P sort of signature, again, Farrago, which is it, or Farrago, or this is a chance for people to express their anger, but about what, you know, kind of people who are very much removed from the intricacies or knowledge of the case and before actually any inquiries sort of came out. But I think that there's an interesting positioning in both of those, because it's the son as the caring. You know, she's not a great kind of punmeister. There haven't been the storming, ebullient, incredibly kind of humorous front pages of Kelvin McKenzie outside, or even actually of a Piers Morgan at the Mirror. You know, it has lacked a bit of that kind of, you know, macho character and laugh out loudness about it. Mm. But that's probably not stood her in bad stead. I think that's, you know, as, again, as I say, sort of if you said what characterises Rebecca Wade's son, I'm not sure that you'd be able to put your finger on. I think she certainly abandoned some of the middle ground that David Yelland went for. He went a little bit more towards the Daily Mail, and she was much more kind of populist but family oriented. The other thing, of course, is lots of stuff about sort of our boys in Afghanistan. I mean, if you're talking about her sort of serious campaign, she's done some very good stuff
Help for Heroes.
Help for Heroes, etc.
Okay, plenty more comment and analysis on this, including a special feature. Oh, I wrote that on mediaguardian.co.uk.
It's been an absolute pleasure to bring you the very latest breaking news from the world of sports. You've helped make this channel great, and we've enjoyed very much reading the hundreds of thousands of texts and emails you've sent us.
But after 572 days, 13,728 hours, and what must be millions of minutes, it's time for us to say farewell. Throughout that time, we've brought you more than just the day's news. We've invited you, the fans, to take part in our coverage. And many of you were here in the studio on Saturday afternoons along with us.
Well, they put on a brave fight, but the knockout blow was finally delivered to Setanta. The broadcaster was placed into administration at the start of the week, and the signal switched off hours later. About 200 employees have been made redundant, and the rights to the channel's Premier League football games have been sold on to the Disney-owned American sports broadcaster ESPN. They're going to set up a new UK channel. Paul Robinson, the one thing this whole episode shows is that it's very risky to televise sport.
Well, the bottom line is, if you're going to say to people, pay for a service, you've got to make sure it's totally compelling. And ultimately, there is only one sport that is so compelling people will pay of the order of £20 a month for, and that is Premier League football. And they had 46 games, you know, arguably maybe not enough, but 46 games is not bad. Having lost 46 games, you know, there's no way you can possibly continue. There's no way you're going to support people paying that sort of amount of money. They also overpaid, I think, for all the other rights. And if you look at the sort of revenue potential for this business, you know, they're going to take about 250 to 300 million a year from subscriptions. They had spent vastly more than that on sports rights, so the sums were never going to add up. And in the wake of Sky, who actually do a very good job, these guys were just doomed.
Well, Setanta tried and failed to compete against Sky. ITV Digital tried and failed to compete against Sky. ESPN, Emily, they're going to...
Well, it's a different kettle of fish because it's got a much, much, much bigger backer. I mean, the issue there will be what ESPN's long-term strategy or what Disney's long-term strategy is in the UK market, and whether or not there is room for two main sports channel brands.
This is a big step up for them, though, isn't it?
It's a huge step up for them, and I think that there is also, that Paul is absolutely right, there is really money to lose in this market, and actually Sky have pretty much got it nailed down, and they do it extremely well. You know, that's the other thing, is that you will do well in coming into a market like this where you sort of thoroughly understand it and where you've actually got a weak incumbent, and rather like Sky actually sort of had brilliant people like Dave Hill who came in and really understood sort of sports rights and paid for sport and did a great job when they actually sort of got the Premier League rights to start off with. Completely trounced ITV, hadn't understood the value of live football. We're not in that situation at the moment. So if Disney can afford to lose money in this market for 3 to 4 to 5 years and we get to the other side of digital switchover, then there is potentially sort of an interesting kind of, there's an interesting player in the market. And don't forget that Europe have been fairly consistent in a regulatory sense in saying, we think that actually sports rights should be unbundled and sold competitively. It is a pain in the backside for the user. If you want to see Premier League football, you would rather it was all in one place where you paid one subscription, and actually that the regulatory firepower was aimed at keeping the price low. You know, you actually don't want 3 or 4 or 5 different providers. You want one provider who's really fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, Paul, is quality going to be an issue here? Because ESPN don't have a lot of time to set up a channel, hire all the presenters, and actually convince subscribers that they're going to present a good service, do they?
Well, I think the context here is that ESPN in the US is huge. I mean, it is the sports brand. If you look at the Disney portfolio, when they acquired ABC Capital Cities, they acquired, you know, the ABC network, ESPN was the bit that was sort of smuggled in the back, and they didn't realise really what quite a jewel they had, but it has proved to be the jewel. And ESPN is the one brand they use when they're talking to Comcast and the other big cable companies in the US. ESPN has got regular built-in kickers on its revenue every year. Automatically, it goes up every year because of ESPN. ESPN is huge in the States.
The
quality is fantastic. I mean, it is a brand that's got massive advocacy. Any sports fan will say ESPN, ESPN in the US. So the play for Disney here is this. It's not just about ESPN. It's whether ESPN can be used to lift their entire portfolio of channels, which is largely at the moment Disney Channel and its offshoots, and whether that can create a bouquet of services which would encompass far more than children's that ESPN could be the granddaddy of and really build up. So I think the issue is going to be, are they going to invest long term? This is an opportunistic thing that's come along. They've grabbed it. It's going to be a bit kick bollocks to get it on air, but they'll do it. And then, as Emily says, the long term strategy is, are they going to invest consistently to build ESPN into a European sports
brand? Quick final word from you, Emily.
Yeah, I think that it's actually beyond TV this as well, which is, if you think there is going to be an increasing world where you have one or two brands that totally dominate genre distribution,
This
is actually about, you know, streaming and on demand on the web, and it's about a worldwide brand. So it's a little bit like MTV for music.
Getting their foothold
like
into
BBC
the UK market.
BBC for the news, whatever, exactly. So yeah. I think it's not actually just about the short-term digital rights on a broadcast platform.
Well, look, Satanta is no more, but don't worry. You can follow the football season when it starts again by listening to our very own and very free Football Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/audio. Well, next week, the great and the good, or should that be the good, the bad and the ugly, of the UK radio industry meet for their annual shindig. The 2009 Radio Festival takes place in Nottingham at a critical time for people with their ears glued to the wireless. Commercial radio's on its knees, the BBC's been accused of paying its jocks too much money, and there's still no agreement that DAB is the right platform to take radio into the 21st century. Well, Trevor Dann is the director of the Radio Academy. He came into the Media Talk studios earlier, and I began by asking whether the 2015 switch-off date outlined in the Digital Britain report was too ambitious.
Well, we don't know, do we, Brookie? I mean, nobody knows, but we might as well have an objective, a key performance indicator, as we probably call it in modern companies. We might as well have a go, because if we don't, radio will get stuck in its analogue past, and it does need a digital future. So let's give it a go. There's plenty of problems on the way. We've got to get the content more compelling. There have got to be more stations, more programmes that drive the marketplace towards digital stuff, not just DAB, but, you know, digital delivery of radio.
Because the industry tried that over the past 3 or 4 years, lots more digital stations, but they came and went, didn't they?
Well, we haven't found an economic model yet, have we? Radio's got no more problems than television and newspapers and other media. We do have one issue, though, which is we haven't got a cover price, so we can't raise our cost to the consumer. And so when the advertising tanks, which it has recently, then we're in trouble and the BBC's cutting back and everything else. But the answer, of course, is content. And if we don't drive that market by attracting people to digital programming, then we are finished.
Is there a case to be made that the radio industry is weaker than it was at the time that everyone went on to FM? Because clearly that was a success, whereas the whole digital offering and DAB seems to have the industry in a bit of disarray.
Well, it depends how you define the radio industry. You see, I think you're in the radio industry now. I think Spotify are in it. I think Amazing Radio are in it. I think there's all sorts of new business models that are being created, models which say radio is just a marketing tool for an online transactional offer. I think we've got to find new ways to make this stuff work, because clearly people like it. People like audio. They like the fact that they can listen to it on their Walkman or on their phone. You know, we can't deny people all those different platforms. The digital future is the multi-platform future.
All right. Well, we've got the Radio Festival next week in Nottingham, your hometown. Tell us what some of the highlights are going to be.
I'm really looking forward to Tim Davey and Stuart Taylor from GMG and others talking about the Radio Council and how the BBC is going to work closer with commercial radio. I think that's going to be really important and interesting. And I think the other highlight for me will be Jeremy Hunt, MP, telling us what the Conservatives think of Digital Britain, but most particularly for us, what they want to see radio do. You know, we don't know really what the Tory policy on radio is.
Because Hunt was quite impressive in his response to Digital Britain in the House of Commons, but that was more about regional TV news. I didn't think radio got a look in there.
No, I mean, I don't think radio has had enough of a look in, actually, in the whole coverage of Digital Britain. And I don't think it's, you know, it's at the top of anyone's agenda apart from the radio industry. But on this occasion, we are promised that he will launch what's in effect their, you know, manifesto about radio for, you know, the forthcoming election. And I think it will be interesting because I don't think you can do that knee-jerk thing anymore of saying, oh, Tories, ah, they're pro-commercial radio. Labour, oh, they're pro-BBC. I think some of those certainties have changed. So what is he likely to say? I don't know. I'm really interested to hear.
Trevor Dann there. And Media Talk's going to be live-ish from the Radio Festival next week. Paul Robinson, will you be in Nottingham too?
I will.
And?
Oh, okay, yes, I will be in Nottingham. I've got three gigs next week, one of which is Nottingham. I'm sorry, just confused. I think The thing that Trevor didn't say about digital
is,
He might have said it and we cut it out. I'm sure he did. He's a good man. The thing about this is that now what has been agreed, really, is that the BBC is going to pay for funding DAB. And that's the really critical thing. Three sources of income: the savings from the merger of Arqiva and NGW, the savings the BBC achieves by going from analogue to digital, and then critically, the money saved by not upgrading the analogue transmitter network. People forget, in fact, it's going to cost £200 million to keep analogue going in its existing form. Now, that money can now be turned into digital. So when you add all that together, you've got enough to fund DAB. So that's good, because now commercial radio doesn't have to put its hands in its pockets, and that's been a big barrier. But Trevor's right. The other issue is creativity. And current commercial radio is only lacking from, you know, real killer content, and it's got to improve its game there.
Okay, well, look, no TV this week because the weather's been too good. But before we go, we're going to ask the panel, what did you learn this week? And I've learnt that the Culture Secretary, Ben Bradshaw, thinks that BBC Director General Mark Thompson is being arrogant over the licence fee and top slicing. Emily Bell, what did you learn this week?
I've learned this week that my handbag is undervalued.
And Paul Robinson, what have you learned this week?
I've learned that if it's liable to go wrong, it will go wrong when it's hot. And by that, I mean air conditioning. The hotter it gets, the worse it gets. Our air conditioning failed. But when it got cold again, it suddenly worked. Strange, that.
Excellent. Thank you, Paul Robinson and Emily Bell. Post your comments at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or on our Facebook group. Matt Wells is back next week with that special edition of the show from the Radio Festival. Media Talk's produced by Ben Green. I'm Stephen Brook, and it's been a pleasure.